Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks. Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, you know, fire, an album that bumps eternally. And today, we'll be weaving through a dream in order to revisit Minnie Riperton's debut 1970 album, Come to My Garden.
Come to my garden, let the stars fill your eyes. Come to my garden and walk with me.
On the second track from Minnie Riperton's debut album, released in the late fall of 1970, Completeness, it begins this way. You are my completeness, beloved. Every breath of you is my life. Thrill me with your own lover's magic. Make me know that I'm alive. Magic just has to be one of the words used to describe this album, and here are a few good reasons. 2120 South Michigan Avenue gets mentioned often, a place prolific enough to be considered a Chicago landmark, where albums from Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, and Willie Dixon and the Rotary Connection were recorded. An address prolific enough to have its own song, an instrumental by the Rolling Stones included on their 1964 album 5x5. Come to My Garden was a magic bus of talent, a seemingly perfect angel with an otherworldly whistle register, and a pocket full of lyrics like sonnets that floated out of her mouth and into our consciousness. Alongside Charles Stepney, Ramsey Lewis, Elsa Harris, and Maurice White, they were arguably the best starting five to come out of Chicago. Chicago pre-Ye and Chance, pre-Twista and Jay Hudson, pre-Common and No ID. Come to My Garden is a liberating sensual experience, big, booming, and baroque, sweeping with strings and choruses, a mythical place where melodies reside alongside bees and things and flowers. Shout out to Roy. I'd say it's a visual experience, but in my opinion, it's best listened to with your eyes closed. So you can soar through Centerville's rainy day and into Les Fleurs. So you can feel the love she loves to sing about. So you can feel it spiritually, which brings me to this. Whether intentional or a divine happy accident, so much of this album feels like Song of Solomon, a poem about desire, sensuality, and the soul, where a woman's self-description, just like in the scriptures, includes her own, quote, sunborn blackness. With its drama and its built-in cinematography, Minnie Riperton and Charles Stepney made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And just like God said to Adam and Eve, come to my garden. What awaits you? Adventures in paradise.
Come to My Garden was the album pick of our guest today, one of the greatest talents ever to come out of the City of Angels and the pride of Locke High School, Patrice Rushen. I had the honor and privilege to interview her a few months back to help write the liner notes for a reissue of her hit 1982 heat rock, Straight from the Heart, which just came out on Vinyl Me Please. And in there, I try to make very clear that if you want to understand the import of Patrice, you really have to turn to the history of American pop music, especially in R&B, and try to find how many other people are as multi-hyphenate as she is. She's musician, singer, writer, arranger, producer, composer, musical director, professor. You name it, she has done it, and then some across her nearly 50-year career. I assume her students at USC call her Professor Rushen, but I think she's earned the right to be named on a single-name basis alongside the likes of Stevie, Curtis, or Quincy. Patrice, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this. Why did you want to talk about Minnie Riperton, and in particular, why Come to My Garden?
Well, the Come to My Garden album really was a game changer for me. I originally wanted to be a film composer, so I was always attracted to textures inside of orchestration, and of course, because I loved dance music and R&B, as well as jazz, whenever I heard anything that blended or seemed to address any one of those areas, it caught my attention. And this album was pivotal for me because Charles Stepney had always been one of those arrangers and orchestrators that I began to understand had those sensibilities, total command of those sensibilities, to be able to work with groups like Earth, Wind & Fire and with Ramsey Lewis and Soulful Strings meant that he understood very, very clearly the African and African-American diaspora, but he had total command of orchestration and of rhythms and certain kinds of textures and attitudes that weren't typically a part of music that we would classify as being more urban or classify as being black or classify as being R&B or pop. So Minnie Riperton, her style of singing, I became aware of her when she was with the group Rotary Connection.
Yeah.
And her voice, the clarity and purity of her sound, and it was not a huge, huge voice, and we typically would associate a certain kind of soulfulness and feeling with a larger kind of voice, but all of those elements were there in this sound that was so pure and clear. Mm-hmm. And the positioning of her extended register and how fluidly she could use it as her instrument of expression. You get those two elements together of Stepney and Riperton doing almost what's an art book, an art song book.
Yeah.
And I was totally hooked. Mm-hmm. And in listening to it, it really validated that it's okay to love a lot of different things, and in the hybridity of those things, celebrate something that comes out of that, which is, again, different and beautiful.
Only in the time it takes to tell you, for not to tell but to know is wrong.
Patrice, you mentioned that you had already been familiar with at least some of Stepney and Riperton's sound because of the work that they did with Rotary Connection. And I found this quote someplace where Chess Records, that Rotary Connection was signed to, or one of their sub-labels, Cadet Concept, but they described the band members as, quote, the hottest, most avant-garde rock guys in Chicago, unquote. And thinking about Rotary Connection, not necessarily their sound, but just what they represented, their composition as being a very notably multiracial band. Mm-hmm. They were sort of like Chicago's version of what Sly and the Family Stone was doing in the Bay Area. Morgan, what was your introduction to Minnie? Was it through Rotary Connection first?
You know, actually, I heard, the first song I remember hearing was Loving You as a little kid.
Sure.
They played on the radio here, which was 103.9 KCE, and then I'd hear it on KGFJ. So that was my introduction. I came to Rotary Connection later, and I came backwards. I came through, in fact, Masters at Work, who redid Black Gold of the Sun.
Yeah.
And so which led me down the road of sort of researching who is this and what is this sound. And that's where I discovered Rotary Connection. And in turn, that's where I sort of discovered that whole psychedelic orchestral soul thing that for me was a revelation.
Right.
Not just the sound of it, but to your point, sort of the multiracial band. I just didn't know of that before. And I came to know more about it sort of through Sly and the Family Stone and sort of that sound. But this for me was my introduction to Minnie Riperton, and what an introduction it was.
Right. Patrice, to come back to you for a moment here, because you were already familiar with Rotary Connection, were you really anticipating this specific album? And we always like asking this, how did you actually listen to it? Did you buy it on, I'm guessing probably vinyl LP, because I don't think cassettes were that big yet in 1970. But if you bought it, Rick, where did you get it from? How did you first listen to this?
The Come to My Garden album was something that was introduced to me by a friend.
Mm.
To your point about the different musics that were going on and what people were doing right around that same time with Sly. See, Sly was out here, and I'm from Los Angeles, so I know exactly what you mean in terms of everything was beginning to change with this coming together of different types of people working in these bands were heretofore. It had been pretty segregated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think where people lived and where they were from was also a part of their sound.
Right.
So there was what the thing that Sly was doing that was very Bay Area based, and then it was not a surprise that those people, as you call it, the sort of the cadet area, they were Midwest. They were all from the same area. And I think that, you know, you can't escape also hearing the kinds of influences that came out of that area.
Yeah.
Even though they were doing similar things. That was a great time, I think. Things were opening up so that the idea of what it was to be able to make music, there were pioneers that just went for it. They weren't looking necessarily for things to have to be commercially successful. Not that they didn't appreciate it when it was, but the impetus wasn't that.
Right.
It was just about the music and making stuff happen.
In speaking about Posh, I read a great quote where you said, with the dream I had been listening to Minnie Riperton's Come to My Garden, one of my favorite albums. With Charles Stepney's arrangements, I saw that he didn't have to use large instrumentation to be orchestral in his approach. So the dream was an homage to that kind of writing.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about Come to My Garden that inspired you, especially in terms of your own writing and production? What is the Charles Stepney touch on this album that affected you?
His orchestration never fought the pulse of any song that he wrote on. And when I say that, it's a little bit different because Come to My Garden obviously were his pieces. But where I became aware of him was the writing that he was doing as an arranger for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, the horns or strings or whatever was added in an overdub situation, where most of the time the rhythm section had been recorded together. And then if there were extras like horns or strings or vibes or this or that, they were overdubbed separately. But his writing always sounded organic. It always sounded like everybody was in the room at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's because he was so masterful at his selection in terms of how he used space, the selection in terms of what instruments were going to complement best the song, and definitely the lines and the use of harmony. Always was an enhancement, never a fight. You know, like, look at me. That was impressive to me. So when I heard Come to My Garden and I could hear it being so organic, if you will, because as a writer, as a composer, you typically think in terms of the composition itself, and your imagination very quickly gets into what instruments would best suit what I'm trying to say. And that's a little bit of a different process, and one that great orchestrators have together. They have memorized the sounds and the textures of all of the instruments, and when they're writing hearing that. And to be able to hear that orchestral mastery in the context of music that was based in the Black vernacular, game changer for me.
Another quote about Stepney was from The Guardian, and it said that Charles Stepney was a fabulously cantankerous genius who dismissed critics who accused him of overproduction, that he was inspired by jazz rather than funk and strings rather than synths, and his vision of psychedelic soul was about spiritual elevation. So a lot to say about his process and what he brought to this, and as I was sort of saying in the intro, a lot of this album feels very spiritual to me. That's how I received it when I first heard it, and that's how I received it this morning in prep for the chat.
Mm-hmm. I believe that's why he attracted certain kinds of artists and musicians to him, based in that fearlessness and always finding ways and resonating with his own truth to resonate with that truth in yourself. Yeah. You know, it took me a long, long time to finally be in a situation where I thought I was going to meet him. Earth, Wind & Fire was recording in town. Earth, Wind & Fire played my high school prom.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
They used to rehearse, you know, as a band starting out, struggling, you know. They used to rehearse periodically at our high school. They knew our high school band director. Our band director, Reggie Andrews, who was the one who introduced me to come to my garden, by the way, and became my first producer. He would ask the kids, go help them take their stuff out the car and put their stuff in the garage and put their stuff in the auditorium so that they help them get set up and pay attention and watch. And that's what we would do. And they couldn't pay us, and so what they did instead was they played a set at our high school prom.
That's amazing.
So I've known those guys for a long time. And when they would record in Los Angeles or be rehearsing as they got bigger and bigger and bigger, periodically they would allow for some of the kids that they had met to go by and watch. And the day that I was going to go to the studio to observe a little bit, Stepney went into the hospital and passed away. So I didn't have that opportunity to tell him how much his music had transformed my thinking in terms of the way I would approach arranging.
Yeah,
I was going to say, just mention, you said something about that I really love about how many influences Charles Stepney brought to his arrangements. And I grew up listening a lot to Earth, Wind & Fire because that was my father's favorite band. He loved jazz fusion, and outside of that, he wasn't listening to the Weather Report or early Miles. It was Earth, Wind & Fire, period. And so I feel like I came to know Charles Stepney through Earth, Wind & Fire, that I started to understand a little bit more about what black music could be, what soul music could be, that it could be all these things, that it could be big and sweeping and dramatic and gospel-y and soul-y. So to your point, I think Charles Stepney, what I learned about him is there isn't just one way of doing soul music. There's a whole lot of things you can put into that soup. And I learned it before I even got to Minnie Riperton. I learned it first through Earth, Wind & Fire, particularly those early albums.
And it's worth noting for listeners there, if you have not heard our conversation with Rafael Sadiq from last summer, where we talk about That's the Way of the World by Earth, Wind & Fire, we go on a long Charles Stepney tangent there. And I want to come back to something about something that both the two of you have said, which is that his understanding of instrumentation. And for this album, of course, one of the greatest instruments he had is Minnie Riperton and her voice. And I was thinking about how, especially throughout the 1970s, singers like Denise Williams, singers like Patrice Rushen, for example, who had these lighter, higher voices, made for a very stark contrast with what I think of as the kind of 60s Aretha era of soul singers, right? Not soul singers, soul singers, right? And from that, Minnie, even amongst people that she's sometimes compared to me has always struck me as being unique, partly because her range, of course, is really unparalleled, for at least within pop music. I'm sure there's opera singers who can do the same thing. But you were not hearing that kind of range in most of pop music at that time. And in particular, the use of that whistle register that is, it doesn't even feel human on some level because it just gets to that high point. So can we talk a little bit about, just in terms of a sound and as an instrument, what makes and what made Riperton so distinctive and how she was able to deploy her voice, least of all on this album?
You know, as great singers go, she was also a very fine technician.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of practice and muscle memory and focus. And, you know, singers, you know, I bow down to them. And I say them because, you know, I still see myself as an instrumentalist who sings. That's different from a singer for me. Singers have some unique issues that they have to live with. They wake up every day and they don't know what kind of instrument they have. See, at least when I go to the piano, I can have a headache, stomachache, leg hurt, whatever. I can press the key down and I can get something.
Yeah.
So for her to be the kind of technician also who could place her voice where she needed it to be or where she wanted it to be at any given time, and you know, the right amount of air and the right amount of compression and the right amount of all this, that's a big deal right there. Then you add to it the musicality, the gift of storytelling that comes out of her delivery, which involves yet again another layer of what it means to be a great singer. And all the singers that you mentioned, Aretha, and, you know, you could just, any great singer, they also have an element of storytelling in their delivery of the words. And to be able to capture that and make it somewhat personal and then find the way to execute, all of that is going on with every line that you hear.
Yeah,
I think one of my favorite sort of showcases for that whistle register on this album is the track "Expecting." I mean, it just, she floats.
Mm-hmm.
She starts out big with the benefit of those drums. I mean, shout out to Maurice White, and then she just floats out of it. So as you were mentioning control, I mean, I'm not a singer. It's a concept I really don't understand except, you know, theoretically. But on that track, it's just like, I don't know how many takes there were, if it was one take, what was going on in the room. But she makes me feel like I'm flying, especially on that song, which is so mythical to me. I don't even really know what she's talking about. She's talking about 16. But it makes me feel like I'm being told a story. Mm-hmm. And I think the perfect complement of that instrumentation, as you mentioned, and as Oliver mentioned, and that register is just like, it's just the 1-2 punch.
Well, we will be back with more of our conversation with Patrice Rushen about Minnie Riperton's Come to My Garden after a brief word from some of our sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
I listen to Bullseye because Jesse always has really good questions.
What did John Malkovich wear when he was 20?
I don't know how to describe it.
There's always that moment where Jesse asks a question that the person he's interviewing has not thought of before.
I don't think anyone's ever said that to me or acknowledged that to me, and that is so real.
Bullseye, interviews with creators you love and creators you need to know. From MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Hi, I'm Biv.
And I'm Teresa.
And we host When Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting.
Whether you are a parent or just know kids exist in the world, join us each week as we honestly share what it's like to be a parent.
These are really hard questions.
They are really hard questions.
I don't have any answers for them.
I don't either.
Sack of garbage.
No.
The end of the show will just be 5 minutes of Biz and Teresa crying and screaming until the outro is played. So join us each week as we judge less, laugh more, and remind you that you are doing a great job.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back on Heat Rocks talking with Patrice Rushen about Minnie Riperton's 1970 Come to My Garden.
Just to go on a brief tangent here, Patrice, you were mentioning earlier about some of the things that you learned from listening to this album when you were just at the beginning of your career, and you had the opportunity to, in a sense, perhaps mentor another artist younger than you, which is when you were the musical director for Janet Jackson during her second world tour, which was behind the Janet album. This was back in the mid-1990s. And I'm wondering, what were some of the things that you think Janet would have learned from you, or perhaps vice versa, on those 2-3 years that the two of you were working together?
Most of my contact with her, you know, ironically, even though I was music director for that tour, was limited. as on those huge, huge tours by that time, you know, sometimes the artists, once you have had your initial meetings about their vision and the ideas of what it's going to take to logistically to execute that vision, I didn't have quite as much contact. I had met her years before she became who she became. Mm. And the family and the other, I was probably the closest to Jermaine. Mm. So, and knew Michael and Marlon. Those are the ones I knew the best.
Yeah.
But of course, Janet was a baby and she was around a lot. So I periodically got to see her. And as she became the iconic figure that she became, I actually talked to Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. Because her producer, they were her producers,
yeah.
And they used to come to see me a lot. So when I was touring, we would kid each other like, "Oh, you guys here again, huh?" And what I came to find out later was that a lot of what vocally they heard, they helped that a lot of that became. You know, one of several influences for Janet as they were working on her different projects.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't think about it then, but of course, later on, I could hear that when I, especially with the albums that you know, like Control and things like this. So, I don't necessarily, I'm not able to answer your question specifically as far as what she may have picked up or gotten from me.
Yeah.
But obviously, there was a connection that. By being asked to be her music director and by knowing Terry and Jimmy as I did and them, you know, just telling me, there was, you know, that idea of being able to learn something
right.
and pick up something and use it, which is great.
Right.
That's fine.
And that makes sense because, you know, Janet did not have a big voice. She had a
nope.
very light voice. And so
mm-hmm.
a lot of it is, what can you do with that? And I think this is
exactly.
something across, of course, your recording career. You know, as you were saying before about practice, about mastering, it's something that you had to learn with your own voice as well. So I could certainly see the connection, least of all as people who grew up in Los Angeles as well and knowing a lot of the same folks because of the music industry here. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. That's
sure.
fantastic.
As we're talking about light voices, one of my favorite is a singer named Lynn Fidamont.
Mm. Oh, yes.
You know Lynn Fidamont?
I do.
And she's got this beautiful song, and I heard as a kid, I have to shout out KGLH and KACE, again, LA Radio, because I grew up here, but it was called I Love You.
Mm.
And, you know that jam?
I know that one. Yeah.
And so that's, to me, one of the prettiest lighter voices that I've ever heard, and also as we're talking about, you know, a level of control,
mm-hmm.
And just for listeners to just go back and get into her discography.
That belongs to you. You are there in my dreams. All I want.
I want to go around the horn here and get everyone's fire tracks.
Okay.
So in other words, you know, Patrice, whatever song that you think just whenever you listen to this album just really, really jumps out to you in the biggest way. And for me, it is LaFleur. I mean, you talk about A1 song. It starts off the album. We actually got into some of this discussion when we were talking about the use of LaFleur to end the film Us when we had Renee
sure.
Bever here not too long ago. And I went back and just compared, because my introduction to the song, which was a Stepney composition, so this is something that Charles had written, it was first recorded by Ramsey Lewis. And let's
right.
take a listen to that version, the original version you could describe of LaFleur. Super pretty. Good enough that Gangstar looped it for their early, really influential jazz hip-hop hit, Jazz Music.
It's jazz music. Jazz music. Music.
You listen to that Ramsey Lewis original, and then you compare what Minnie, just a few years later, does with that same basic composition. And this is no disrespect to the great Ramsey Lewis, who plays on this version, because, again, part of the same Cadet Concept crew. But my God, what an upgrade, especially. And before we even get to Minnie's part of it, just Phil Upchurch on guitar and what he adds to this.
Will somebody wear me to the
fair? It chills. Just chills. Absolute chills. And it's always interesting listening to a song that begins life as an instrumental that then has lyrics added later. And as pretty as the original instrumental version of La Flor is, just the lyrics that get added here, I mean, quote, kiss my petals, willed me through a dream, unquote. The funny thing is, partly because I don't speak French, I probably knew in the back of my head that La Flor is about flowers, but it wasn't really until prepping for this, for today's chat, that I actually sat and really listened to the song and all the flower metaphors.
Yeah.
I think I was always just so caught up in how beautiful it sounded. I didn't actually really pay attention to what was being said. And this song's incredible.
Lyrics are incredible. The feeling isn't, when she comes in, it just gives mm-hmm. me chills, and it makes me, like, in prep for this chat, I said in the intro, you have to listen to this with your eyes closed. And at some point I found my arms extended like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio standing on the front of the boat, you know what I'm saying, with the arms out. And it made me feel like I was flying. And one of the things that Jordan Peele said about this choice was that it was a cleansing palette and that it was the perfect way to soundtrack the shot of flying over this world that's created. And it just gives me chills. I mean, it's a beautiful track. I have other faves on here, but I'm not going to take anything away from it because it moved me in a way that I couldn't have expected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite tracks on this album. You said something really interesting, you know, that, see, we don't know, we'll never know, if the way that we ultimately heard it was not the way that he ultimately heard it as he was writing it.
Mm.
See, a great orchestrator or any great composer has a point of view and something in mind. And so every note, even though we didn't have the benefit of knowing the lyric or we didn't have the benefit of knowing what it was about, was even in Ramsey's version. Except we weren't in on it. With Ramsey's version, you're focusing on Ramsey.
Yeah.
You cannot deny its beauty of melody. You cannot deny its feel. You cannot deny any of those things that made Ramsey's version very popular, because it was. But we had the benefit of knowing more about the inside story because we had lyrics, we had a voice, and all of these beautiful textures now applied to this gorgeous melody and gorgeous pulse, gorgeous feel. Mm. So it's cool. Yeah, I love it. And when she comes in, I know it's exactly what you mean. When she comes in, and it hits me the same way every time.
Yes.
I've probably heard this album, thousands of times, okay? Hits me the same way every time. It's like, wow.
Chills. And one more note from the same article from The Guardian. It says about La Flor, the ecstatic ascent to the final chorus would be absurdly bombastic in the hands of most producers. Instead, this eruption of joy and light is virtually an out-of-body experience, which is such a beautiful way to describe it. Oliver, did you write this?
I did not.
Okay, because this is really...
That's above and beyond, I have to say. I don't know if I would have come up with that.
I mean, it just describes what it feels like. It does feel like an out-of-body experience.
Mm-hmm.
Trace, I'm wondering, what is your fire track off this album?
Oof. I like Completeness.
Mm. Oof.
It's really beautiful. And I love the message, not only the message, you know, lyrically, but the way in which the message is imparted. It's so heartfelt for me.
Yeah.
It's smart also, you know, the orchestration is smart. And I don't know another way. It just reeks of his mastery and intelligence.
Waking me, my love.
There's so much drama on this album.
Yes.
And when you think about it, which I think it just makes such an interesting contrast with Minnie Riperton's voice, which you wouldn't necessarily intuitively think of as being dramatic because it is so light and it's so high. But it is really that balance between what Stepney's doing with the layers of orchestration and its arrangements and then what Minnie brings to it because that voice pierces through everything. And,
yeah.
Oh, this, yeah.
and it is dramatic. And to me, it feels like this song feels like sort of a, since this is the debut album, it feels like a foretaste of things to come. Mm-hmm. That this perfection is what Minnie sounds like when she's singing about love. And the fact that she's in love and she's singing about love, that's where the drama comes from. How love moves her, I think, is how the song moves me.
Yeah.
And so that all that build and those lyrics are just, they just pierce your heart. And I think that's the intent, because this is about love. And that explains the drama of it to me.
You know, we've been talking about her whistle range. At the time when she's offering, you know, full chest voice right there where we were just playing, the strings are in that whistle range way above her. Mm. And then they're going to switch places. The strings go down into their beautiful chord range, and she goes back up to the whistle range.
What's your fire truck off of this?
Yo, I'm in the hot seat because there are so, it's just so hard to pick because I love everything.
Yeah.
I'm just polyamorous where it comes to this album. but I have to say there is something that really moves me about Rainy Day in Centerville.
Mm.
I love the texture of this one. I love how it opens and how it closes. And it is responsible for one of my favorite moments from the album. It's the build into the moment that comes out of the out of a long instrumental one. It was just a point where I thought, one, Charles Stepney is trying to kill me. He's trying to kill me. And it is a song that has me fully engaged on really a cellular level. It's the decisions. And I think both of you have talked about the decisions that are made. When Minnie comes in, how she comes in, that long break of instrumental where we're not even really prepared. And it was a moment, I thought it was a really teachable moment to me as sort of a newish music supervisor, is that how to manage moments. And this was a song that I thought, well, this isn't something that I would place on a soundtrack, because this is a soundtrack. This is a film all by itself that needs no help from me or the benefit of any story I would put. It tells the story all by itself. So it was a real moment for me to think, aha, make smart decisions and make elegant choices. But Rainy Day in Centerville was a is something precious to me from the album.
Two quick observations. One is that when we usually go around the horn and people are talking about their song choices, there's three kinds of grunt reactions that we typically have. There is the, oh, that's an interesting choice, which is like, hmm. There is the sort of, I affirm that decision in terms of, hmm. But it's notable. I feel like every time a song on this album has come up, our instinctual, intuitive reaction is the emphatic, like, and that really is what this album, every song on here brings out of us. It goes beyond just, yeah, that's a good choice. This is at the depths of our soul.
Yeah.
We're saying like, yes.
Every track.
Mm-hmm. The second observation is this, to me, when we're talking about favorite moments on the album, so beyond just a particular song, but really the moments, this is an album that just feels engineered to have so many possible moments that are just going to grab you like that. I mean, I can't even think of a more recent album we've talked about that has this many. I think for me, one of my favorite moments, this would be my honorable mention, would be, and this goes back to something I think maybe was Patrice was mentioning, or maybe it was Morgan. Either way, it is the buildup and release of the chorus on Le Fleur.
Mm.
hard to beat.
Good Lord.
Hard to beat. But that said, beautiful. I think in terms of my favorite, I think I got to go with Minnie Riperton's cover of the Rotary Connection classic Memory Band, which I mentioned in the first half. And let's start with that original version of Rotary Connection Memory Band recorded in 1967. To me, this is hands down one of the most sublime songs you will ever hear. It's a miracle of composition. And if you can describe something as being subtly showcasing without that sounding like an oxymoron, I do think that's exactly what Minnie does here with her whistle register on this version, original version of the song. I'm not going to claim that Minnie's version on Come to My Garden is better than its progenitor, but I do think that on this album, it is one of the most ambitiously arranged songs, and that is saying a lot, because the Minnie Riperton solo album version is a song that begins with bossa nova minimalism. And then somehow, within just a few minutes, gets to this massive-sounding string arrangement and horn section.
Yo.
I'm speechless.
Yo. And I have to keep saying yo. But I also want to say I'm so glad that you picked this one, because the bossa sound of this song actually reminds me of another song called You Love Me Only.
Ooh.
Flora Purim, Patrice Rushen. It is so like, I bought that song before going back to listen to this song in prep for the chat, and I was like, good Lord. So then I had to bump both songs super loud. When I saw my neighbor this morning, she just looked at me like, nah, don't even say good morning to me because of the music. But I have, can we please hear a bit of You Love Me Only from this beautiful 1977 album, Nothing Will Be As It Was Tomorrow. Arranged by another maestro. So thank you for that song. It's one of my favorites, and also reminds me a lot of Minnie's Memory Band.
Patrice, what favorite moment do you have, or moments do you have off this album?
Well, when you talked about the big surprise for me that came out of listening to the song Expecting, because I, too, when I first heard it, I was so enthralled initially with just the sound of it, you know. And then I tried to like pay attention, you know, after I got past that and said, okay, so what is this about? And then in reading more carefully and trying to connect the dots a little bit, it helped me really be able to appreciate even more its stark by in comparison to some of the other things, and how it would just rise and fall just all of a sudden in these waves. This one, unlike some of the other ones where you get kind of prepped for the rise, this one you don't. It just is there, and then it falls in much the way that our emotions take over.
I was thinking of something else I had read about when they were prepping for this, which is that Minnie and Charles were really trying to go for a Dionne Warwick, Brooke Bacharach sound.
Oh, wow.
Which makes a lot of sense when you think about it there are traces of that. I wouldn't confuse this for a Dion, you know, Bert song, but I could see where that influence would have come from. I mean, there's so many great songs on here we haven't even gotten into. We haven't even talked about the title track yet. And this is a song that is less than 4 minutes. I think it's 3.5 minutes. But it goes through 4 to 5 different movements within that. Haven't talked about Only When I'm Dreaming, which is another incredible song.
Oh,
By the Way.
Good Lord, which is responsible for my second favorite moment on the album.
Now that I have found the way, it's up to me.
It's just everything about this, and the tambourine throughout is just sending me. And as Oliver said, there's just so many moments of sonic excellence on here. How can we pick out one?
Right.
I want to also, before we get out of here, I want to shout out Minnie's background singers, Kitty Haywood and also Elsa Harris. Mm. Kitty Haywood, and both Chicago folks, very, very famous. And as I was going deep into Elsa Harris, I saw more about Elsa Harris as a keyboardist than I did as a vocalist. She's part of the Chicago Gospel Keyboard Masters.
Mm-hmm.
And one of her big songs was her cover of Walk With Me.
I believe there's at least one song that we've missed talking about. And I think Patrice wants to mention it.
Well, we've talked about almost all of them except for Close Your Eyes and Remember.
Oh, God.
And this one he wrote also with Richard Rudolph, who was Minnie's husband.
Mm-hmm.
So, or became Minnie's husband. I don't know if they were married at that time. But it's another one of those that has just, you know, a beautiful story that she just delivers with that, you know, purity and poignancy.
The moon was made of cheese, racing swiftly through the mountains, bubbling along the streams.
Patrice, you can't see us because we're in the booth. But both Oliver and I are having physical reactions to all these hits. Oliver's moving his foot. I'm shimmying from side to side. This is a full body experience that we're having in here.
Yes, I believe it, and I understand. I've heard this thing a bunch of times, and when I hear you both speak of it, you speak of it with the same fervor and energy that everybody who is aware of this project ever talks about it. I remember, I was somewhere and Stevie Wonder was in, we were having a conversation just about stuff, you know, and somewhere in the conversation, this album came up and he was like, oh, you know about that? I mean, and he just went crazy for a few minutes with this same kind of enthusiasm that we are displaying right now. So this album is one of those things that the people who know and really appreciated Minnie and appreciated Stepney, they see this as a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as Oliver likes to say, sometimes you need the benefit of hindsight. And listening to the album prep for this chat, it is listening to this knowing that we only had 9 years left with Minnie after she recorded this. Mm-hmm. It's the benefit of knowing not only what we had, but also what we lost, but also what remains. Mm-hmm. And to be able to listen to this as a grown woman and have a grown woman's reaction to it emotionally. And I'm just glad I lived long enough to sort of appreciate it. And also to keep challenging, you know, my notions of what soul music is and all that it can be. And that's certainly what this album did for me, not only challenging those notions, but challenging, you know, my own sensibilities as a music supervisor. The takeaway from this has really been huge. And so I thank everyone associated with this album for giving me that moment, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Patrice, if you had to describe this album in three words, what three words would you choose?
Masterful, thoughtful, depthful.
You know you've lived here all your nights, all your days. You know you've lived here inside my mind. You know you'll stay here for this. You've lived all your life. You know you'll stay.
Last thing is, we always want to leave our listeners with a recommended next listen. I'll start things off here. And I mentioned this earlier, but I think if people were really into this Minnie Riperton debut album, go back to her debut just on recording period, which I don't know if this is her earliest, but go back to that first self-titled Rotary Connection album released in 1968. I want to say it's on Cadet Concept, or maybe it was just on Cadet. But regardless, if you like the ideas that were being played here and you want to get a sense of where she started, you got to go back to that Rotary Connection, that first album, and really all their albums. I think they put together at least four or five in the 60s and early 70s, but you would do worse than start there. Morgan, do you have a recommendation for next listen?
I have two. If you like Come to My Garden, check out the 2018 album from Kadia Bonet, which is called Child Queen. That's the follow-up to her debut album, The Visitor, that was also released on Fat Possum Records in 2016. It's psychedelic and it's orchestral. So for you know, all those sweeping cinematic moments, I'd say listen to that. Just the purity of voice and, you know, what it makes you feel. I would go to 1994 and Carlene Anderson in an album called True Spirit. I came to know her through her work with an acid jazz group called Young Disciples, and that's where it started for me. And then True Spirit, pretty light voice with a lot of power.
Patrice, do you have a recommendation for what listeners should be checking for next after this one?
If you're now even more curious about Minnie Riperton and want to go into some of the other things that she did, Perfect Angel would be a great place to start. If you want to hear more of what Charles Stepney did with singers, pay attention to some records that you probably have heard but didn't realize his hand in it. Certainly lots of Earth, Wind, and Fire stuff, but there's a song called Imagination.
Ooh.
From the Spirit album, which was the last album that he wrote before his passing.
Yeah.
And I'd also say check out his work with Denise Williams on Free.
That will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, Patrice Rushen. Patrice, what are you working on right now?
Well, it's the school year, or it was the school year.
Yeah.
And I'm chair of the popular music program at the University of Southern California, USC. Yeah. So during the school year, I focus on that, you know, the development of this curriculum and teaching methods. We're 10 years old now. It's really exciting to be involved in a program that is so innovative in terms of music education and in allowing the discovery of some of this great music that we're talking about inside of a curriculum where students can see the lineage from Big Mama Thornton to now and be able to see themselves differently when they understand where the music has come from and on the shoulders of whom they stand. And then during the summer, when school is out, I get to do some touring and some playing. I still do some playing on weekends occasionally in L.A., but in the summer is when I can do some things. So right now on schedule is are some dates that I'll be doing at the Newport Jazz Festival. Mm-hmm. I'll be doing some dates with Christian McBride. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get some music finished and be able to start a larger work in collaboration with one of my colleagues that may result in a new opera. Mm-hmm.
And where can people find you online?
You can find me at www.patricerushen.com.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles, where I picture I can return to after the social distancing days are over, but only when I'm dreaming. If you have some extra time, we'd appreciate some of y'all leaving us a 5-star iTunes review, since it is a key way for listeners to come and find our show. One last thing, here is a teaser for next week's episode, which features Bay Area turned LA transplant producer and artist Trackademics talking with us about Sade's Lover's Rock on the occasion of that album's 20th anniversary.
I had been enjoying Sade passively for years. And so in high school, after the Best Of, when that came out, I personally started to really get into Sade. And then Lover's Rock was important because that was a time where I could participate, like as an actual fan, yeah, in real time, not always going back. So that, I think that was the biggest thing. There was a lot of things surrounding it. Me and my friend group, we all were into Sade. But that, I think that was the thing. It was just like, it's almost like very pent up energy. Like, we love Sade. We love Sade.
Yeah.
And never had had an album since we've been like music kids.
Right.
Sure.
Because this is the point in her career where she was putting out maybe an album a decade.
Right.
And
right,
so there'd be long, long distances between them.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.